Hello, Tomorrow Built Today listeners. This is one of your co-hosts, Jana Messerschmidt. For those of you new to the podcast, we cover investing trends and predictions, along with discussions about the latest news in consumer tech. This week, we're doing something a little bit different. We are bringing you three of the talks from Lightspeed's first negotiation summit with Hashtag Angels, Demystifying Power and Wealth in the Valley. It recently took place at Twitter. You'll hear from top negotiators, founders, and investors to hear the tips for negotiating in the Valley. One note to keep in mind is that because we recorded this live, which included a lot of hand gestures and animation from the speakers, the voice quality isn't perfect, but the content makes up for it.
I'm sure a lot of you in the room are familiar with Max and his story. He is an absolute legend in Silicon Valley. But wanted to give you guys a little bit more background because he's done quite a few amazing things. So Max came here. He immigrated here from the Ukraine in 1991 and then went to University of Illinois, which is also my alma mater, ILL, INI, where he majored in computer science. He graduated in 97. And then in 1998, co-founded PayPal and is one of the members of the illustrious PayPal Mafia. We at Hashtag Angels like to call ourselves the Twitter Mafia, by the way. After founding PayPal, he sold PayPal to eBay in 2002 and probably could have rested on your laurels a bit, but decided to found another company, which was Slide, which he then sold to Google. After that, has co-founded several more companies. One is Affirm, which he's currently the CEO of, and also, and proudly wearing the branding, and also Glow, the fertility app. In addition to founding all these companies, he's also been an active investor and board member, investing in companies like Evernote, Yelp, and Yahoo. And has also spent a lot of time in different political and philanthropic organizations. So Max, did I leave anything out? We got it.
That's funny.
Awesome. So you've had to negotiate quite a bit in your career, whether negotiating your venture capital raises, negotiating partnerships, negotiating sales of companies. What are your top few tips on negotiating that you've picked up along the way?
I have too many hard rules. I guess one tip is that it all changes. One thing that's worked really well for me is early on figure out in the negotiation what is your true leverage. Sort of don't lie to yourself about the level of strength you possess vis-a-vis the other side. Normally you're taught to sort of figure out what information you're going to put out there, what are you going to hold back, how are you going to sort of continue to play your cards. One technique that kind of works remarkably well, better than most people sort of realize or advise, is that if you're negotiating against a Goliath, one of the very successful things you can do is just sort of say, okay, here's exactly what I have in my card deck. Like, here's my profit margin. Here's everything I know. Here's what my market share looks like. You now know everything. Now, if we partner, and this is typically works when you're partnering with someone versus selling a company, you could crush me. Like, you could take away my margin, you could force me to pay for things, you could demand co-marketing dollars, and then I'll go out of business. And so if you want this partnership the way I want this partnership, then now that you know everything there's to know about me, let's do something together. And if you don't tell me, then you won't waste my time. And it's remarkable how often people immediately say, oh, no, I definitely don't want you to go out of business. And then they proceed to work together towards some sort of a shared outcome. While if they don't really believe that this is your last dollar or your last resource or your last point of margin, they'll keep pushing because it's their job to get the best deal for themselves. And so that's sort of a one technique that works amazingly well. And it's strange how often entrepreneurs of little companies kind of ask me for advice and say, I keep on offering this thing and these guys are so huge and they keep on pushing. Like, well, have you just tried telling the truth? That's sort of one. Another one in the world of negotiating compensation, it's always a really good idea to offer people a trade cash for equity. When if you're making someone an offer, say, look, you can have this salary and this equity, or more equity and less salary, there's only one right answer if you're hiring this person. If they say, oh, I want more cash and less equity, just withdraw the offer. There's nothing like someone telling you, I don't think that thing's going to grow. I'd like my cash up front. It's actually like the final test in most of these things. Let's see if there's any other really good ones. I'll pause there, but throughout the conversation, I'll try to come back to ideas if they float up in my head.
I'm curious. We have some founders here in the audience today. And can you talk a little bit about the first time that you hit Sand Hill Road in 1998 going to raise venture capital and what that was like?
It was brutal, actually. So PayPal was my first kind of properly funded. So I have lots and lots of, like, I have endless supply of stories being told that this thing, whatever it is that I'm peddling, isn't just not good enough. It's like the worst thing ever. It'll never work, and you're an idiot to do it. And you'd think this was all kind of a ramping up to PayPal, and then PayPal, you're like, oh yeah, that guy's got it. You know, we should put our money behind him. But not at all. After PayPal, during PayPal, after PayPal, now, you know, there's always someone who's willing to tell you, oh, that's the worst thing in the world. My God, that's so overvalued. That's the dumbest idea. This is terrible. Really, really terrible. And it's hard. You know, I've been doing this for, you know, somewhere going gray at this point, so a few decades. And it's stunning how hard that hits you in the face. Like, you'd think that I'd be like, oh, whatever, you know, water off my back. I've raised millions of dollars. And I have, but somebody telling your baby's ugly has exactly the same feeling when you're 21 years old, fresh out of school, trying to raise money for PayPal as it does, you know, these days when it should be a little bit easier. So the sort of classic two tales from my early fundraising FUPAs or flops, even before PayPal, I was trying to raise money for a company that I built prior to that, and I was still in Champaign. I drove up to Chicago to see this guy who was sort of kind of venture capitalist, but he really wasn't. He was kind of a local wheeler and dealer, and he listened to me talk, and I had didn't really have a PowerPoint presentation because I couldn't afford PowerPoint, so I kind of showed it like with a little bit of web page mockups in 1996 or 76. And so this really looked terrible, but he was very willing to listen. He sort of comes and said, son, you're real smart. I don't think I'm going to invest in your company today, but I have several parking lots I'd like you to manage. Would you do that for me? True story. I'm like, that's awesome. I just got a job offer. But no, I need to go back to class. That was sort of the interaction was like, you know, trains passing each other. And I, the other one was, I'll spare you the colorful details this time, but we literally went to every source of money on Sandy Hill Road. We started with sort of the venerable Sequoia and, you know, Kleiner and Excel, and then got bounced out of there faster than you can say no, and sort of went down and down. So you started like, so 3000 Sand Hill Road used to be the address, and kind of changed a little bit now because they're remodeling it or remodeled it. But you sort of go from 3000 then to 2900, then 2880 to 2800 to 2450 to 2420. Like, all of these are real addresses of venture capital firms. I've been to them all. This is just during the PayPal times. And every one of them was just like, nope, 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 nope. And then you get to like Red Roof Ventures, which most people have never heard of, but it exists. I think it's in Saratoga.
Is it similar to Red Roof Inn?
That never crossed my mind, but probably. So this guy was like, you know, I already send my partners home today because I just don't think we're going to invest in one of these money-moving schemes. And like, well, but I have a really strong background in cryptography. It's very secure. He's like, secure? I don't know. Credit cards work fine. And it was one of these, he was this sort of a very nice, portly gentleman who was, this is not actually Red Roof Ventures before I malign someone. This is the next one down. This is like, we're now like in almost Santa Cruz territory where like, we kept on driving south and south and kept on meeting these people. And it was like a completely hopeless, I think we did 100 pitches and 100 no's before we got the first round for PayPal. And it was one of the things where Peter and I were sort of like, well, you know, failure is not an option, so we're just going to keep trying. And the first money in PayPal that was not sort of one of the insiders was this thing called Nokia Venture Partners, which was Nokia's corporate venture arm based in Silicon Valley. These two dudes who were kind of basically just trying to learn venture capital. And the connection was about the slimmest possible. One of their partners was based in Europe, and he had to be Polish. And one of our first employees, Luke Nosek, who was now a partner at Founders Fund, was also Polish, or at least spoke Polish, and they sort of hooked up around their shared heritage, and that was enough for them to walk into our office and like, we're not letting you go until there's money on the table. And it was kind of a long and painful fundraising story, but it worked out in the end.
And juxtapose that with your most recent fundraising for a firm. It probably looks a little bit different.
It's a little bit different. There's not a lot of who are you and what have you done and what right do you have to raise the money. There's actually an interesting dynamic which is true now, and I don't know how to comment on it in either direction, so this is kind of a factual thing. A firm has always been a little bit outside the hype bubble. We try pretty hard to stay, and we're a very, very mission-driven company. There's a very strong view on what we do and what we don't do. And in many ways, kind of hyping ourselves up and kind of telling everybody how we're gonna 10x any second now is a little bit counter to the ethos of the company. Like we grow very quickly. All of our KPIs look fantastic at the moment, so pretty happy with the company performance. But we sort of stay a little bit out of the spotlight. And so one of the interesting dynamics today, especially in fintech, is that companies that get the best sort of most receptive responses in fundraising are people who are really, really good at hyping up what can be. And so I sort of had to, and it worked out okay for us in our last fundraising, so I'm not complaining. But a year and a half ago when we raised our last round, I was sort of like, oh, I need to like get out there and like start talking us up. Oh, it's so weird. I'm so used to being, come discover me, And so it's interesting. Actually, it's a new skill that I had to develop in my veteran-like age.
So you've sold several companies. You sold PayPal to eBay, and then you sold Slide to Google. Talk a little bit about the negotiation of the sale of the company, and then curious, who's a harder negotiator, eBay or Google?
eBay for sure, but eBay today is very different from eBay back then. So Meg ran the place with an iron fist, and we're friends now. But So Google actually was an interesting dynamic because it was one buyer, one seller. I didn't want to sell the company. They were sort of casually interested. We met. It was one of these things that they had a very strong view on what they wanted to do. We kind of agreed that it made sense, and it wasn't really like a hard haggle. The corp dev people came in and sort of frisked us over again and sort of said, well, we think you're worth this much. And said, that's great and all, but until you get to this number, I'm not even going to consider it seriously. And so it was a little bit of a price haggling, but both sides knew that we had other options, and in the end, we sort of agreed a number, and it was okay. With Google, actually, it was a good negotiation in a sense where they're very, very pro-employee retention, and so long as you align on a notion of we are bringing, because ultimately, you're selling a company that generates $10 million or $10 billion in revenue, Google doesn't really care. They're well north of $50 billion now, and so unless you're like somehow a miraculous money mint, they're just getting good people, good ideas, and strategy. They're not really buying revenue. And so the revenue multiple is the wrong way of thinking about it. It's all about, can you get us great people? Will they stick around? Will they build good things for us? And so Google negotiation allowed, because they were smart and creative, they essentially said, look, here's a big pile of money. It can't go anywhere but your employees. And everything else is negotiable. I said, fantastic. I know exactly what to do with this. And we built a really nice, it's a fairly complex structure, but it worked out great for all involved. And plenty of people are still at Google, which means that not just wealthy, they're also happy. eBay had a lot of great anecdotes where there was many different stare downs where they would come in and say, you just raised money at $350 million, I'd like to buy you for $400 million, say it ain't so. We'd say, absolutely not, the company's worth twice as much now. Meg would look like she's gonna burst a vein. And she had the very, very sadly departed CFO, sort of one of her closest partners, a guy, Rajiv Dutta, who's passed away a little bit ago, but was as brilliant as he was emotional for a CFO. It's probably a job hazard, but there's one time Peter and I were sitting across from Meg and Rajiv, and Meg says, look, so they would come up to our last ask from their 50% number every time. So there was like a 4 or 5 offers, and every time we'd walk away. The reason we went public is in part because we kept on telling them, you're undervaluing the company. I said, well, you're not public, how do we value them? You know what? Gonna go public. But then we didn't really go public to teach eBay a lesson, but it was a little bit of that. But the stare down right before we went public, Rajiv and Meg were sitting across from us and said, well, we think the company's worth $800 million. I said, well, we think we're gonna go public at least a billion. It's not fair to our shareholders to sell at this price. And Meg looked up and said, you guys, you understand that your entire business is built on our shoulders. and I don't remember the exact words, but she said something to the effect of, you guys are throwing a party in our backyard and you're charging for admittance. Like how? which is sort of what PayPal business model was. Like we were basically providing transaction services to eBay sellers without paying eBay anything. And we sort of retorted with something like, well, you know, we're happy to share some revenue with you guys, but we're definitely not interested in selling a company below the market value. And meanwhile, I was like barely 23 years old, so I was sort of watching Peter take on this extremely powerful woman. Kind of like, how, I don't know how he's holding up under pressure. I'm terrified. She's going to crush me like a bug that I am. And so then Rajiv sort of comes up and says, if you don't sell this company, we will fight. Oh, we will fight. Oh my God, I'm going to die. And we walked out and he said, and so as we left, he's like, I don't think they're ever coming back. Did you see Rajiv? The guy was so angry with us. And sure enough, a year and a half later, they acquired the company at a premium to the public price. So it worked out in the end. But throughout the process, it felt like it was a constant sort of knives out, you know, full-on fight battle, which actually it had a sort of a less amusing consequence. By the time the transaction closed, it was very clear to both sides that the management team of PayPal was not welcome to stay. And so one by one, all of us were basically not asked, but kind of told that we can leave anytime we like.
And do you feel like it was just a culture clash, or what was the reason why they wanted everyone out?
Actually, I think the biggest part of it was they knew that PayPal was an extremely tightly knit team. Like the PayPal Mafia, as much as they dislike the term, it's sort of stuck now, was a bunch of people that got together kind of planning to make this our last startup unless we're going to go start another one ourselves. And so there's a whole, like 100 people that all said, oh yeah, this is definitely where I'm going to cut my teeth and then I'm going to go start my own thing. And so as a result, it was a little bit of a, you know, not quite cult of personality, but close, where a lot of these folks were my classmates, Peter's classmates, classmates of classmates, you know, friends from high school. And so as a result, I think eBay management team knew that if the founding managing team was allowed to stick around, there would be too much kind of who's my real boss, eBay, or the guys that I went to school with. And so it was a bit of a, and retroactively or retrospectively, I don't think they did the wrong thing by telling us we should all clear out whenever we feel like it, because it's not obvious to me they were wrong about the possibility of mutiny. And so, and I think, you know, for all of my snarky comments about Meg, I think she's a fantastic CEO and kind of a brilliant manager, and very, very tough-handed one. And so I think, I don't doubt it was not an easy choice for her to say, you know what, we're going to lose all these top guys because who knows, maybe their reports won't listen to us, but she didn't hesitate once she decided to do so.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you caught Maggie Neal's presentation, but she talked a little bit about differences in men and women negotiating and how women are actually the best negotiators you can hire because we negotiate better actually on behalf of our companies, but typically we have a harder time negotiating for ourselves. And I'm curious, as a leader who's managed many executives, what negotiation techniques have you found to be effective when someone comes in and asks you for a raise or a new title or a new job scope? And also, if you can comment on kind of like differences between men and women when they negotiate.
The best way to kind of move up the ladder, so to say, that I've seen is actually, I mean, it depends a lot on the manager you're speaking with, but the best management advice I've ever received was from a venture capitalist many, many years ago during Slide, who basically said, the number one trick to being a great manager is you have to deeply invest yourself in your charge's success and career. Not in this company, not for your mission, not, like, go find out what they want. 10 years from now, do they want to be on a farm? Do they want to run this company? Do they want to run some company? Do they want to start a company? You have to know the answer to that, and you have to work hard enough to get the real answer, because there'll be the first answer of like, oh, of course I want to make director and, you know, and then VP. But that's not, like, sometimes they might want to have a family, and other times they might want to have a family and retire, and sometimes they might want to have a sabbatical to get their master's, and those are real goals, and you have to be fully bought into them, and you don't have to like them, and you can argue that they might be stupid goals, but once you know what they are, it's your job to help them get there, because you're not just their manager, you have to be sort of a caretaker of their career. And so ideally, when someone walks in and says, well, I'd like to go get X, the first question I try to ask is, well, do I know if this is collinear with this person's path to their goal? If the answer is yes, then we're completely aligned. I want you to get X and you want to get X, great. Then we just have to figure out, how far are you from it? Are you there? Are you not there? Let's describe what that means. What do you have? What do you not have? Like, let's have a conversation around that. It's a lot harder if you say, I always thought you were going this way, and now you're telling me you kind of wanted this. Those are very difficult conversations because I immediately feel like I didn't do my job figuring out what that person truly wanted, or the person was confused and they didn't really ask themselves the right question. And sometimes the information changes and all that stuff. But the best conversations are always around, okay, cool, I get it. This is on path to where you want to go. Ultimately, wonderful. Let's assess this part. Are you actually an excellent writer? To be a great manager, if that's what you're trying to do, you have to write a lot. So are you good at writing? If you're not, let's talk about that. And so those are not very difficult. I think all the sort of compensation conversations are just proxy for kind of career progression. Like, a lot of it is sort of here's where the company is, and that's market, and that's where we are, and I can get here but not there, and those are not extremely difficult to state and negotiate. You have to be honest. You can't say one thing to one person and something else to another. That really backfires very quickly because there's no such thing as compensation secrets. But other than that, I think the real difficult stuff or the real sort of meaty stuff is always around, where are you in your career? Do you have the requirements necessary to take the next step?
Got it. You talked a little bit about just people who want to have families. So I just want to touch for a moment on Glow, because I think it's such an interesting company that you started. And you were kind of focused on fertility before fertility became cool, right? I think there's a lot of venture dollars that are going into fertility companies. I know #angels, we've invested in several ourselves. How did you get the idea, and what have you kind of learned from running that company? Because my understanding is you wanted to take a really data-driven approach to allow people to hopefully be able to have children naturally.
Yeah. I wish there was some kind of a beautiful, gut-wrenching, sort of personal struggle, tearjerker story behind it, but there's no such thing. There's a little bit in the end of the story, but it's a little bit more prosaic than that. So between companies, I kind of gather a band of merry friends together and brainstorm ideas, and sort of sometimes it has a name, other times it doesn't have a name. But we just sort of brainstorm, what company would I start if, you know, wanted to change the world? And one of the topics that we had, one of the brainstorms we had, was what's a cash pay part of medicine where, you know, healthcare, where you need to actually put up the money yourself. And spent a lot of time talking about all sorts of crazy stuff, but basically the idea was, is there some way to dramatically reduce costs for people that have to pay a lot of money for some kind of treatment? And there's all these different things that you pay a lot of cash for. Much of it is hard medical problems that data will not help. And then sort of on a way out of, somebody said, I think infertility is like a massively expensive, like IVF is a very expensive procedure. I don't know anything about it. By the way, this is a bunch of dudes. So it's 100% male brainstorm about fertility. It's already kind of a mistake. And that sounds interesting. I don't really know anything about it either. Like, my wife and I literally just got pregnant with our first kid at the time. And so it was sort of like, okay, well, infertility sounds like a real problem. I don't know anything about it. And then I called a friend of mine who was my sort of number two at Slide. And I said, hey, Mike. And he was in Shanghai because Slide had an office in China. He moved to China for me to set up that office and had a baby there and stayed. And had a baby with his wife, who's also in Shanghai, to avoid any salacious implications. So I called Mike and said, hey man, I'm thinking of this crazy fertility idea. And he and I have been talking about starting a company together, just sort of to reprise our experience. And I started telling him, you know, thinking about fertility is interesting. He said, stop, we're gonna start this company together right now. Really, like that's strong. Like, he's normally the most measured, careful, kind of a very, 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 very careful guy. He's like, I never told you this, but my daughter was born after many, 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 many rounds of IVF. We'll never have another kid again. Like, she's the miracle baby. Like, I was born to do this thing. And so it went from being this like, oh, neat, data to help people conceive, to holy crap, Mike is like, he's been carrying the flag for a long time and just didn't know about it. And so it's actually quite a thing, because when we presented the company at All Things D many years ago now, he sort of got on stage and told a story, and he'd never done it before. I mean, in private, obviously, I knew by then, but it was a big thing for him, where he just could not quite get over the shame and the difficulty of talking about infertility. But I'm not allowed to say the exact number, because we're coming up into a big milestone, but there's a lot of babies born to women who have self-identified as infertile. Their OBGYNs told them they're infertile, their doctors told them there's nothing they can do, and it's entirely natural. No drugs, no IVF, no IUI, just regular, usual way of trying to conceive. And it's pretty stunningly successful, like how big it is and how many lives it's changed.
It's incredible. So I have one more question for you before we open up for the crowd. But you're very active politically and philanthropically.
I was just about to say, the one thing that I'm not sure I agree with, I'm not that active politically. I try really hard to stay out of it.
Well, I will say you've been a great outspoken force on things like immigration reform and prison reform. And, you know, over the last few months, there's been quite a standoff between Pelosi and Trump on immigration. Curious who you think is winning that negotiation.
I think the country's losing. That's the important thing. As much as I dislike politicians of every flavor, I certainly have my pecking order in that pair, but I think there's a little bit more than a pissing contest going on at this point there, and threatening shutting down government jobs for about 1 million people to drive an agenda on either side, I think, is pretty bonkers. So I'm neither Team Trump or Team Pelosi in the popcorn eating, you know, rounds of the mutual humiliation society there. I kind of wish they would get over it already and solve this little problem. And that's about as far as I'll go with that. I mean, I have other choice words, but I think there are some press members in attendance, I understand.
I think maybe we need Maggie to come in and solve and frame it as solutions orienting.
Yeah, there's definitely a solution waiting to happen in there involving less grandstanding.
Great. Well, we'll go ahead and open it up. Does anybody have questions for Max?
I realize that I'm the last thing between you and the end of this, so if you have no questions, I will not take it personally. I always found it painfully difficult to network. So, to be honest, I would go to Silicon Valley parties and then just kind of leave from the back door within 3 minutes. Just like I cannot take the extrovertedness that takes place. I'm one of these people that's sort of a sub-6 extrovert. If I'm in a room of less than 6 people, I can sometimes be life of the party. Once you get me in a room of 6 plus, kind of want to hide. So I don't have the sort of be gregarious, you know, go at it and enjoy meet new people advice, because I certainly don't follow it. I think the thing that's really amazing is how far people will go when you ask for advice. Like, you can't ask for kind of a lame advice or too generic of an advice, because then people can be like, oh, I know what you're doing. You're just trying to get me to network with you, and yawn, okay. But if you come in and say, hey, you're an expert in X, and here's a thoughtful question about X, it's stunning how far people with extreme levels of busyness in their life will go to say, oh my God, that's such a thoughtful question. Let me dig in on this with you. Pretty often those people even on like an hour-long conversation, will then go to a great degree to tell you anytime you want to talk to me, anytime you want to reach out, I know people, I can connect you to people who can help you with this. And so the short version of, I guess, the advice is when you're trying to form a network that will help you achieve your career goals, depth is better than breadth. Like having lots of superficial conversations, at least for me, have been kind of a useless thing because, one, I don't suffer them very well, and I expect people not to suffer those too well. If you find someone, doesn't matter where they are in their career or in their position in life, and have a really thoughtful question that you can really dig into, they'll tend to open up a lot of access for you, even if it's just a single conversation, so at least for what that's worth. But I am no expert on networking. Like, I got very lucky with a PayPal crew because just the right number of people at the right place at the right time.
Yes, back there.
How did I find opportunities to invest in? There's a different story in every one of them, so there's not really a pattern. So Yelp was kind of probably my greatest lucking out. And so Jeremy was my classmate at the University of Illinois, but we never met. And so it was one of these things, it's a big enough school where you can be in the same year, same computer science major, but we never really intersected. But he was at PayPal. He was kind of my number two in the engineering org. And right after PayPal, he went off to do HBS, and I wrote his recommendation. And I sort of spent a lot of time telling him how I thought business school was a waste of time, and he really shouldn't do this, and it's such a dumb idea. But he's like, look, man, I want to go. Write me a letter. So I wrote him a letter. And then the summer after his first year, he came back and said, well, I'm bored. And I'm definitely going to go back, of course, but I have to tell you, you may have been like half right about how HBS is a lame idea. I was like, oh, I'm on a mission now. You're never going to go back. And so I basically just talked his ears off until we found something that he was passionate about, and that became Yelp. And so in that sense, I mostly just played, you know, a log where I have laid myself on the rails of the train that was going to take him back to Boston, and got lucky there. A lot of other things, I mean, if you're successful a little bit, the kind of fortunate reality is that people seek you out to get a little bit of that success advice / mojo / whatever. And so you sort of bootstrap your way to access. Also, I try not to be a jerk. So I think people like investors who are not jerks. Like, there's plenty of that are, and so it's not that hard to stand out.
I'd echo what Max said. I think as angel investors, our value add to founders is that we're operators and we have expertise having built a lot of different companies. So it's kind of figuring out like what it is about your personal experience that founders, it will resonate with them. Because especially right now, there's so much capital in the market that there are a ton of people who are angel investors. There are tons of new funds that are sprouting up. Like money is usually kind of like the last thing that they need. They really just want your expertise. All right, you guys, thank you so much for attending. And Max, thank you for being our final speaker here today.
If you want to find out more about Max, you can find him on Twitter at mlevchin or levchin.com. That's L-E-V-C-H-I-N. Thanks again for listening to this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, please go to iTunes or wherever you are listening right now to rate and review it. You can also find us at tbtpodcasts.com. Tomorrow Built Today is produced by Lightspeed Venture Partners. The theme music you heard today is by Mikhail Manveyan.